Hello, this is Andy Bobek, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the November 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article that I started last week about the Ramones, and then an article about Randy Newman, and a book review about the Greenwich Village music scene, and a classic album review of Rio by Duran Duran. Okay, the article about the Ramones that I started last week is titled New York State of Mind, 50 years since their instigation and 10 since the passing of their last original member. The Ramones' rock and roll revolution maintains a living legacy. But was there ever a more unlikely success story? Chris Needs returns to the birth of the band, unraveling a tale of blood, toil, tears, sweat, more blood, heroin, OCD, dumb genius, and perfect timing. They ignited the powder keg that was waiting to be ignited. And this is where I left off last week. The band's first UK press came in November 1975 after NME's Charles Shar Murray saw a Performance Studios showcase. Presently enthusing, the Ramones are a band the London rock scene could really use. Geez, I'd give a week's pay just to see them explode over an unprepared audience at, say, Dingwalls. They're simultaneously so funny, such a cartoon vision of rock and roll, and so genuinely tight and powerful. When his portfolio of duties started getting too much for Tommy, Marty Fowle, manager of the disintegrating New York Dolls, was asked to take on the commercial side. While Sire Privet carried over signing the band, Thou passed, but agreed to produce I Want to Be Your Boyfriend and Judy is a Punk for a single at Ultim Studios in Blavant, 20 miles northwest of New York City. Then Danny Fields saw the band live and started co-managing with Seymour Stein's wife Linda. Finally, after Linda persuaded her husband to attend a showcase, the Ramones signed with Sire. And here's some of that Ramones song, I Want to Be Your Boyfriend.
What do you say? Do you love me, babe? What can I say? Because I want to be your boyfriend. Hey, little girl, I want to be your boyfriend. Sweet little girl, I wanna be a boyfriend.
Craig Leon produced the first Ramones album in 1 week in January 1976 for only $6,400 at Plaza Sound above Radio City Music Hall in Manhattan. Built in 1932, the huge space had been used by orchestras, big bands, and Rockettes rehearsals. I credited Tommy with associate producer because that album was basically his concept, says Leon. He didn't execute anything, but the whole thing about the band was him. So he was like the commander. It wasn't a particularly live record, like everybody tries to say it was. There's not a lot you can do with the Ramones, just a lot of layering and texturing. Tommy was very regimented, and Joey was coolly professional, unlike Dee Dee, who was almost impossible. Seeing the Ramones as the ultimate all-American band, Arturo Vega, now the band's combined artistic director and live lighting designer, came up with their presidential seal logo, making them the first punk band to establish a merchandising profile. They sold more t-shirts in the 70s than records, said Fields. Released in April, Ramones was the 29-minute Big Bang that changed music. Reviews were mainly ecstatic, Lester Bangs declaring in Screw, "It's a great record," and the Ramones, in their drive and economy on every level, are punk revolutionaries. While Crawdaddy's John Swenson demurred, calling the Ramones dumb pseudo-limeys from Queens, who sound like a lampoon parody of Blue Cheer, Rolling Stone's Paul Nelson praised its songs, constructed almost entirely of rhythm tracks of an exhilarating intensity rock and roll has not experienced since its early days. In the UK, its impact was unarguably more seismic. Your writer sat with early champion John Peel as he hammered the album on his Radio 1 show, gleefully proclaiming the songs are all the same, but they're all different, if you know what I mean. Later, I'd watch Sid Vicious, yet to become a Sex Pistol, plunking along to Blitzkrieg Bop, until announcing, "I can play bass now." Outside the small world of CBGB, the Ramones often seemed quite overwhelmed by this sudden attention. At the Roundhouse in 1976, by far their biggest show to that point, the cheering prompted them to break their own no-encores rule. But if they needed a reality check, it was close at hand. Because, says Denny Fields today, when we go back to New York, we still couldn't get a gig in New Jersey. For the Ramones, the future held 13 more albums and 20 more years of shows. These would be new drummers after Tommy's 1978 departure. Marky, Richie, and briefly Elvis, a.k.a. Blondie's Clem Burke, and a new bassist, CJ, after a final falling out with Dee Dee in 1989. There were musical diversions of a sort, as when Phil Spector produced their string swap 1980 version of the Ronettes' Baby, I Love You. But, in some ways, the dynamic established at the onset rarely changed. Johnny and Joey remained at opposite poles politically, their personal relationship almost non-existent after Joey's girlfriend, Linda Danielle, transferred her affections to Johnny in 1980. John crossed the line. "I never felt any love for John anyway," growled Joey, who responded by writing, "The KKK took my baby away." And here's a little bit of that song by the Ramones, "The KKK took my baby away."
She went away for the holidays, says she's going to LA. She never got that, she never got that, she never got that, they say, yeah. She went away for the holidays, says she's going to LA. She never got that, she never got that, she never got that, they say, yeah. The game, game, game.
the singer's OCD, among other health issues, culminating in the cancer that eventually killed him in 2001, made everything about being in a band difficult. Joey was treated with kid gloves, recalls Danny Fields. Monty Melnick and Arturo Vega took a lot of extra time with him. Those two were Ramones as much as the four guys on stage. Dee Dee passed in 2002 of a heroin overdose. Johnny, 2 years later, of prostate cancer. In 2024, the Joey/Johnny fault lines survive the band as Linda Cummings and Mickey Lay battle over rights. With a proposed Netflix biop starring troubled TV comedian Pete Davidson, a major bone of contention. The miracle of the Ramones is they kept going as long as they did. 50 years ago, the odds seemed impossibly stacked against them. As Joey told me in 1987, we were doing something completely alien. Now everyone's tried to copy us to some degree, but nobody comes close. It's just our attitude. It's ourselves. And here's a side article, Ramones the Movie. With an errant star and wearing estate, will this brothers biopic ever get made? Chris Needs investigates. In April 2021, Netflix announced the acquisition of Joey's brother's Michael Hyman's, a.k.a. Mickey Lay's, book, I Slept with Joey Ramone, as the basis for a biopic, with the singer to be played by Saturday Night Live actor, comedian Pete Davidson. However, the proposed movie has since run into a numerous problems, not least the battle between Hyman, Lay, and Johnny Ramone's widow, and Joey's ex, Linda Cummings, Ramones, that's been ongoing for 20 years. The Ramones' 1996 split left Joey and Johnny controlling 50% each of the Ramones Productions Incorporated, holding company that controls the band's music and assets. When Joey passed in 2001, his mother, Charlotte, inherited his share. Handed to his brother after her 2007 death. After Johnny's death in 2004, Linda became his executor and conflicts escalated. In 2018, Hyman sued Linda over use of the Ramones' name and unauthorized projects, including a Ramones ranch in L.A. Then, in January 2024, Linda sued Hyman and manager David Frey for $1 million for allegedly cutting her out of film and merch deals, accusing them of ignoring record labels or business managers and draining funds. She told the New York Post she was trying to protect the Ramones' legacy. Left to me by Johnny Ramone on his deathbed. Linda also accused Hyman of threatening to leak his brother's compromising private footage of her, which he denies. Hyman and Frey stress the film isn't a Ramones biop and focuses on Joey. Besides, they claim Linda signed off on the film in 2006. But the rights battles is not Netflix's only problem. Pete Davidson, from a working-class Staten Island background, his father was a firefighter who perished at the World Trade Center on 9/11, and comfortably over 6 foot tall, seems in some ways ideal for the role of Joey. Perhaps too ideal. With a high-profile love life, including a short-lived engagement to singer Ariana Grande and a fling with Kim Kardashian that provoked the ire of her ex, Kanye West, Davidson has his own mental health issues. He has been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and PTSD, and has spent time in treatment centers as recently as this August. Meanwhile, the Hyman Frey camp concede that the impasse with Linda may be affecting Netflix's enthusiasm for the movie project. It's concerning. Hyman, who sold some of Joey's publishing for $10 million, told the New York Post, "I have a feeling they're not happy about it," adding, "The Beatles aren't any less popular with all the things we've heard about them. People are still gonna love the songs. I don't see the legacy being damaged." That Ramones movie, less a biopic, more a soap opera? Okay, now I'm moving on to the article about Randy Newman titled The Unquiet American. In 1974, Randy Newman, the agent provocateur of singer-songwriters, unleashed his greatest provocation, a barb that speared racist bigotry and liberal hypocrisy alike. In a chapter from his in-depth new Newman biography, Robert Hilburn unpacks the complex genius of Good Old Boys and its speaking the unspeakable anthem, Rednecks. He knew the song was going to upset people, to put it mildly, but it's how he saw the world. And here's some of that song, Rednecks, by Randy Newman.
I saw a TV show with some smart-ass New York Jew. And the Jew laughed at Lester Maddox. And the audience laughed at Lester Maddox, too. Well, he may be a fool, but he's our fool. And if they think they're better than him, they're wrong. So I went to the park and I took some paper along. And that's where I made this song. We talk real funny down here. We drink too much, we laugh too loud. We're too dumb to make it in no northern town. We're keeping the others down. We got no neck. Men from Texas, good old boys from Tennessee, college men from NSU, when in dumb, come out dumb too, hustling round Atlanta in their alligator shoes, getting drunk every weekend at the barbecue, and they're keeping the niggas down. We're rednecks, we're rednecks. We don't know our ass from a hole in the ground. We're rednecks, we're keeping the niggas down.
Notwithstanding his apparent lack of pop star looks or rock star cool, Randy Newman's star was rising as a solo singer-songwriter. This scion of a Hollywood movie music family with roots in New Orleans had made strides since his craft had found him a home at Warner Brothers' hip and ambitious Reprise label. A favorite of boss Mo Osteen and his young, artist-focused A&R Lenny Wandeker. After penning hits for Gene Pitney and Alan Price and partnering Van Dyke's Park in the engine room of Baroque pop sensations Harper's Bazaar, Newman's solo albums were success d'antan until Sail Away dented the Billboard chart in 1972. Stunningly written and arranged and eloquently produced by Wanaker and Russ Tittleman, it wove exquisite spells and asked thorny questions, not least in its title song, where Newman posed as the pitchman for a ship carrying African slaves to America. Its historical evil all the more crushing for being so blithely disguised. And here's a little bit of that Randy Newman song, Sail Away.
You get food deep, won't have to run through the jungle and scuff up your feet. You just sing about Jesus and drink wine all day. It's great to be an American. Ain't no lion or tiger, ain't no mama snake. Just a sweet watermelon in the buckwheat cake. Everybody is as happy as a man can be. Climb aboard, little wog, sail away with me. Sail away.
But as the following chapter from Robert Hilburn's new book describes, Newman was set to flirt with still greater danger on his next album, using words authentic to a new Southern white narrator. Committed to his perceived ancestral vocation of keeping the N-words down, in a song that would evermore crystallize his bravery as an artist and his humanity. Holy hell, we're gonna die, Elliot Abbott wisecracked, mostly when Randy Newman first played Rednecks for his day-to-day manager in a New York hotel room during a brief East Coast tour in 1973. He knew the song was going to upset people, to put it mildly, but it's how he saw the world. Abbott said years later, I loved it. There was no hesitation on anyone's part at Warner Brothers, certainly not from Lenny, Mo, or Russ when they heard it. And why should there be? When someone with Randy's artistry puts the truth in front of you, what are you going to say? You've gone too far? The path to the song began back in December of 1970 when Newman turned into ABC TV to see talk show host Dick Cavett interview Lester Maddox. The segregationist governor of Georgia, many of the race-baiting Southern figures in the United States Senate, notably Strom Thurmond of South Carolina and Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi, had faded from the national scene. But the outspoken Maddox, a former restaurant owner in Atlanta, was part of a proud new wave of Southern stalwarts. Maddox came to national attention when he responded to the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964 by vowing to close his restaurant rather than serve black customers. He threatened African Americans with an axe handle if they dared walk into his establishment, and so relished the public attention that he began selling souvenir axe handles for $1,000 each. Newman detested Maddox's views and looked forward to seeing him make a fool of himself on Cabot's show. But the program was a major disappointment, an ambush in which Cabot and his guest ganged up on the governor, causing him to eventually walk off. Upset by what he saw as grandstanding, Newman wanted to write a song about the incident, one that would express Maddox's bigotry and, at the same time, condemn the hypocrisy of the North about its own segregationist practices. By the end of 1972, the song was beginning to take shape. It would be the foundation of a concept album that would put the song into a wider context. At a time when slipping a few love songs into his repertoire would have been a winning commercial strategy, Newman doubled down on his underlying instincts, songs that mattered to him. I sort of knew that I wasn't going to change things in the country, but I felt I had a duty to try and make people like me a little better, he said. It isn't like I was pandering politically or anything. I said what I meant. That was always in my mind. In late 1972, Newman began working on songs to fill out the concept album. I felt I needed to explain rednecks, Newman said. I wanted to show why the guy in the song would be so angry about the hypocrisy surrounding the racial issue in this country. That's what the song was about. I wasn't trying to forgive the South for its role in the treatment of black people, but I wanted to point out the North couldn't take all this moral high ground. I wanted to continue the discussion of race. One song wasn't enough. On hotel stationery and in spiral notebooks, Newman spent months outlining a series of songs that gave the redneck's lead character a wider cultural context. Over more than 45 pages, Newman listed potential song themes and titles, page after page of revised lyrics, and even many portraits of personalities in various songs. When Newman's A&R producer, Lenny Wanaker, saw the notes, he was amazed. Newman had never come close to devoting that much time to an album. On one sheet, Newman described how he pictured his redneck's narrator. Not unsympathetic character, despite the racial slurs. Married with a 2-year-old daughter, living in a small apartment in Birmingham, Alabama. Possibly works in still mills, and on weekends and free time, serves as a counselor/playground supervisor at a park nearby. Fairly intelligent and intellectually restless and dissatisfied with his life. Newman even gave the narrator a name, Johnny Cutler. The rush of ideas and crossed-out lyrics documented how Newman seemingly questioned every line of a song to weigh its place in the story. Whole songs came, Birmingham, Marie, and often went, if we didn't have Jesus, the joke, and my daddy knew Dixie Howell. At times, Newman put words down simply as placeholders in the album. Uninhibited, wild, bar-type sing-along thing, crazed blues, song to the father, possibly upon father's death. He also proposed various noises between tracks to link the songs, phone calls, TV shows, traffic, children, plane. And here's some of the song Birmingham by Randy Newman, off of his album, Good Old Boys.
Got a wife, got a family, earn my living with my hand. Rolling steel downtown Birmingham. was a barber, the most unsightly man. He was born in Tuscaloosa, he died right here in Birmingham. Birmingham, Birmingham, the greatest city in Alabama. You can travel across this entire land. There ain't no place like Birmingham.
Aside from brief trips for live shows, Newman spent the rest of the year on the project. Of particular interest in the Johnny Cutler notes was Birmingham, because it was the song, after Rednecks, that he told us the most about Cutler. The lyrics went through several revisions, where he began one version with the line, "Let me tell you something." He eventually dropped it and went directly to Cutler's background. He later rearranged some verses and threw out others altogether, including a peck into Cutler's self-destructive side with a tale of building a summer home in Huntsville that he burned down for fun. Ultimately, Birmingham exhibited a compactness and detail that was characteristic of the finest short stories. My daddy was a barber and a most unsightly man. He was born in Tuscaloosa, but he died right here in Birmingham. Another song that would become a defining number, Louisiana, later Louisiana 1927, is only mentioned in the notes as a possible entry. It grew out of Newman's longtime fascination with the Southern state, thanks in part to his mother, who told him stories about the region, including the state's Depression-era governor, Huey Long, and the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. And here's a little bit of that song, Louisiana, by Randy Newman.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. The river rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. The river had busted through, clear down a Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana. That tide will wash us away. That tide will wash us away. Louisiana, Louisiana. That tide will wash us away. That tide will wash us away.
The most destructive river flood in the country's history, covering more than 25,000 square miles, with water sometimes reaching 30 feet high and uprooting hundreds of thousands of people. It had such a shattering impact that it's no wonder some of the nation's most respected musicians have addressed it, from blues figures Charlie Patton and Bessie Smith to Bob Dylan. The power of Newman's Louisiana 1927 is that it sidestepped the concentration on personal struggle in the earlier tunes to confront the factors surrounding the flood, including politics and race. In a single, illuminating line, Newman speaks for all the Louisiana flood victims and anyone who felt they had been sacrificed by the federal government and even their local public officials. They're trying to wash us away. Talking about the song years later, Newman recalled an experience he had while on tour in Mississippi. There was this older guy driving me around, a liberal volunteer-type fellow, he said. We talked about this and that, and I asked him why people in the state that don't have health insurance didn't jump on Obamacare. And he said, well, we don't like being told what to do. And that's especially true if something is coming from the North. Early in 1973, Newman was ready to move forward on the album that he was calling Johnny Cutler's Birthday. He had been playing individual songs for his producers, Wanaker and Russ Tittleman, for weeks, but neither had heard the songs collectively. Newman, too, wanted the songs on tape to better measure what he had. At Warner's Amigo Studios in North Hollywood, with Tittleman at his side, he recorded 13 songs with just voice and piano, introducing each with a few words to explain the song's place in the story. Prefacing Rednecks, he said, this begins with the sound of children playing, presumably some boys playing football, and in the distance a park band concert. Johnny Cutler and his daughter are at the park, presumably sitting on a park bench. There's some desultory conversation. Cutler says, why don't you play with those kids? And she whines a bit. Ultimately, after he loses his temper, she goes off and he quiets. The kids' voices fade and he begins singing, last night I saw Lester Maddox on a TV show. In some of the introduction, Newman seemed to be speaking as much to himself as to Tittleman, still trying to find his way through the lyrics and sequencing. But there was nothing tentative about his voice, and he appeared comfortable admitting he still had questions about the album. Rarely far from humorous asides, Newman introduced a song titled Birmingham Redo by saying what is to follow is highly tentative, even more tentative than what I've done up to now. Not crazy about it. Tittleman was enthusiastic. It was going to be totally unified, something like a Berg opera, where nothing really happens, but everything is revealed. He said in a Warner newsletter at the time. Listening to the tape later, Wanaker thought the story had a cohesion and plot discipline that might make for a compelling stage musical. Newman spent the next 2 months on a tour that was preceded by a warm-up date on March 16th in Lafayette, Louisiana, where he thought it might be time to preview Rednecks. As good as a song might sound in the studio, there's nothing more informative for an artist than hearing an audience's response. In Lafayette, Ellett Abbott sensed Newman sizing up the audience in the show's early moments to see if people were paying attention to the words and seemed to be understanding the songs. Satisfied they were tuned in, he began Rednecks. I was holding my breath when he got to the N-word, Albert said. There was this hush in the club, as if everyone was thinking, whoa, what did I just hear? I didn't know what to think, but the crowd quickly picked up on what the song was about. When he got to the line about Harlem and the South Side of Chicago. The place went wild. Randy was elated. But Newman later got a letter from a young black man who was at the concert and was disturbed being in a room with 1,500 white people who were standing up when Newman sang the slur word. Randy phoned the letter writer and explained why he used it, trying to assure the man of his purpose. Newman was encouraged by how well Rednecks was received in the North and South, but he was still uncertain about the Cutler album. Sensing his frustration, Wanerker and Tittleman talked him into returning to Amigo Studios for 3 days in July of 1973 to make a demo of the songs that Newman felt most strongly about, including Rednecks, Birmingham, and Louisiana 1927. They hoped it would help him visualize the rest of the story. As Newman juggled the Cutler songs, he began thinking about more songs in the style of Louisiana 1927, which led him to all the outlandish tales he had heard about Huey Long, Louisiana's controversial governor and then U.S. Senator. Even in the 1970s, Long, nicknamed the Kingfish, remained such a polarizing figure in the state that the mention of his name could lead to heated arguments. True believers cheered Long as a populist who defended the common man against corporate greed and political indifferences. Yet he was reviled by others in his home state as a corrupt demagogue whose state administration was filed with scandal and abuse of power. Newman wrote a song about Long, Kingfish, and became intrigued by reports of another Everyman a King that was co-written by Long as a campaign rally sing-along. And here's a little bit of that song, Kingfish, by Randy Newman.
A 100,000 Frenchmen in New Orleans. In New Orleans, there are Frenchmen everywhere. Your house could fall down. Your baby could drown. Wouldn't one of those Frenchmen care? Everybody gather round, loosen up your suspenders, hunker down on the ground. I'm a cracker, you one too. Don't I take good care of you? Who built the highway to Baton Rouge? Who put up the hospital and built your school? Here come the kingfish, kingfish. Everybody's saying, here's the kingfish, kingfish. Every man a king.
He couldn't find a recording, but a southern cousin remembered the song from childhood. He sang it for Newman, who took the words down and then located the music in a museum in Louisiana. The lyrics, which Newman later backed with a ragtime accompaniment that gives his recording the feel of a turn-of-the-century stump speech at a county fair, portrayed Long as the friend of the working man, the one who promised to save this land. Newman thought it helped explain the us against them anger of the state's lower economic class, the prime rednecks constituency. And besides, said Newman, it's a pretty snappy song. I wonder how much of it Long wrote. He did it with Castro Corzo, the bandleader at LSU. Early in 1974, Wanaker and Tittleman tried to jumpstart Newman's creative process again, thinking the singer might look forward to arranging and conducting. They booked a studio to record the orchestral portions of Marie and the alcohol-soaked Roland, but things bogged down when Newman refused to do the arrangements. He appeared worn down from the months of working on the album and touring. 2 days after the album's September 10th release, protests broke out in Boston, one of the cities called out in rednecks, over the role of busing to achieve greater integration in the public schools. Fearing the album might worsen the tension in the city, Boston radio stations agreed not to play Good Old Boys. Even without protest, however, AM program directors throughout the country, likely concerned about the album's content, avoided the LP. FM programmers did showcase selected tracks. As before in the debate over Sail Away, critics backed Newman. Rolling Stone summarized the LP as a continuation of Newman's deceptive miracle work. It mystifies, it confuses, it entertains, it swings. You don't know whether to laugh or cry, and that is Randy Newman's rare and bizarre skill. As soon as the album was released, a hot topic among Newman fans was which was the better album, Sail Away or Good Old Boys. Preferring Good Old Boys to Sail Away, Robert Kistow wrote in the Village Voice, contrary to published report, the white Southerners Newman sings about from are never objects of contempt. Even Newman's psychotic and exhibitionist and moron show, dignity and imagination, and the rednecks of the album's most notorious songs are imbued by the smartass New York Jew who created them with ironic distance, a smartass's kindness cut of all. There is naturally a darker irony. No matter how smart they are about how dumb they are, they still can't think of anything better to do than keep the ends down. To promote the album, Warner scheduled a concert in Atlanta, a move inspired by MGM's lavish premiere of Gone with the Wind at Lowell's Grand Theater in 1939. Newman would debut much of the album on October 5, 1974, at the 1,700-seat Atlanta Symphony Hall with an 87-piece orchestra conducted by his uncle, Emil. The Warner Publicity Department announced that Lester Maddox, who was seeking re-election, had been invited. However, Maddox, who would eventually lose to a moderate candidate endorsed by President Jimmy Carter, said he never received an invitation. He also professed, unconvincingly, that he had never heard rednecks. The evening was beyond fantastic, Russ Tittleman recalled. Randy played the whole record and probably a few other things, and he had so much fun. I remember him introducing Emil, who was wearing a black tux and bright orange socks, which you could see from the audience. Randy said, I'd like to introduce my uncle Emil, who came all the way from California to embarrass me in front of all of you. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Rio by the band Duran Duran, 1982. Despite popular memory locating new romanticism as a backlash to punk, the most famous band of the genre, Duran Duran, stemmed from John Taylor's declaration that the band was intended to be a combination of the Sex Pistols and Chic. But this band from Birmingham, England, did things, as the song states, their own way. Duran Dumonium swept the globe with 1982's Rio album. It heralded the arrival of the music video revolution. I think Duran Duran owes its life to MTV. Norman Shamrock of MTV's parent company, Warner Communications, told Time magazine in 1983. The flamboyant videos to the title track and Save a Prayer by Russell McCulkeny, who went on to make Highlander, portrays the band as sophisticated jet-setters, lolling around exotic locales with beautiful women. These clips epitize the 1980s spirit, as does the album's artwork. Patrick Nagel's cover painting captures the decade's graphic style, its Japanese woodblock look, typifying a fascination with the exotic. And here's a little bit of that song, Rio, from Duran Duran, off of their album, also titled Rio. Demonstrates in songs such as New Religion and The Chauffeur how far John Taylor bass, Roger Taylor drums, and Nick Rhodes keyboards define the band's sound, glossy, sexy, slick, and infectious. But Simon Le Bon, vocals, and Andy Taylor guitar are equally vital to the overall experience. With Le Bon's obscure lyrics and, not always technically sound, vocal delivery, augmented by Andy Taylor's guitar, giving tracks such as Hungry Like the Wolf a rock edge that made them accessible to a mainstream audience. And here's some of that song, Hungry Like the Wolf, by Duran Duran. Rio, Era, Duran Duran were matchless in their ability to craft perfect pop that defined a decade. And unfortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the November 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with the book review that I didn't get to today about the Greenwich Village music scene. And then I'm going to read an article about the B-52s, also an interview with the people in Sade's band, and a classic album review of Rust Never Sleeps by Neil Young. Until then, this is Andy Bombach for Mojo Music, saying so long and keep rockin'.